Welcome to On Demand with Jenna Ellis. This is our AFR exclusive podcast where we do a deeper dive into the issues and news of the day that you need to hear about from, of course, a biblical, truthful perspective and with guests that you want to hear from. And so, of course, the top story that has been in the news this week is all about Iran and Israel and that conflict and then how America should respond, if anything. Should there be any sort of U.S. intervention? Of course, President Trump and some members of the America First agenda in Congress are suggesting absolutely yes. There are others that are more on the far right, if we can characterize it that way, including Representative Thomas Massey, who introduced a bipartisan bill this week in the House, saying that there would be no war powers that are exercised. And of course, we know constitutionally that the president still has some unilateral executive decision-making responding to some conflicts, but an actual declaration of war would have to come from Congress. And so there's a lot of different perspectives here on American interventionalism as a whole and just war as a broader topic, and then specifically related to Iran and Israel. So let's break it all down with my guest this morning, who is Daniel Horowitz, who goes by RM Conservative on X. He's a senior editor at The Blaze, a writer, a policy analyst, and host of the always fascinating CR podcast that you can find on iTunes and wherever podcasts stream. So Daniel, thanks so much for joining for this really important conversation. So first, your kind of broad 30,000 foot perspective on this particular conflict.
Sure. Well, yeah, what a boring week, you know, what's not going on. But the truth is, it is kind of fascinating that obviously there's a lot that could happen, still very volatile. But I want to begin by giving you a starting point of two data points. Number one, the price of oil is down. And number two, the Israeli, I guess, equivalent of their DHS announced that they could go back to work as long as they're maybe reasonably within a, you know, distance to a bomb shelter. So that in itself is just extraordinary, because that is within a quicker time period than the Six-Day War. And, you know, they have managed to essentially degrade the Iranian regime and, most importantly, defang their offensive weaponry to a point that they can't really do anything. I mean, they immediately disabled their army and air force and navy, and then they had these ICBMs that now have kind of dwindled, and the command and control structure is crushed. And obviously, and this speaks to the price of oil, which even at the beginning, the spike was pretty modest relative to what you would expect. Remember, when you have a war halfway around the world, oil spikes, and this is 30% of the oil goes through the Straits of Hormuz, which is a stone's throw from Iran. This speaks to the fact that clearly the market is not pricing in, shall we say, World War III. You know, obviously nobody likes a loser. If they would have known Israel was doing this, you would have had, you know, all the belligerents threaten and yell, but they just went ahead and did it. And with God's help, they were successful very quickly. So that's not happening. I mean, Russia's out, you know, China will trash talk a little bit, but there's nothing going on there. And all the other Arab countries are pretty happy, and some even said, you know, or did shoot down some Iranian missiles. So that's the good news, which is, you know, it's really, obviously, this is a network for a biblical worldview. It's very hard to not see God's hand in this, and particularly piggybacking off of the Israeli beeper operation and what they did with Hezbollah, ending the war with them before it even started. Because you can imagine this wouldn't have gotten off the ground, because for four decades, Iran had a gun against Israel's head with Hezbollah, and that's done. So this in itself is pretty extraordinary. And one more thing just to add to that part, you look at Syria, which, you know, I've always opposed any, you know, involvement in that. It was a civil war of bad actors, and they're still bad actors. But at the end of the day, what Israel did, which, and this is important because this is a harbinger for what comes next, and to eschew this false choice of repeating another Iraq versus being a John Lennon, you know, communist peace now loser that some on the right are trying to echo, in that Israel, you know, Syria is right on their border, okay? So if anyone has a sort of rationale for getting involved, it would be Israel. They never got involved in that 12-year civil war. What they did was stand outside of it, and anything that would come into a zone that affected their interests, they would zap it. One day the Shiites, one day the Al-Qaeda, ISIS, whatever it is. So when they saw Assad crumbling, like, look, we don't know what's going to take over. It might be the same, a little better, a little worse. That's not our business. That's not our ability to rectify. But we're going to make sure that whatever emerges, while we're not going to be responsible for nation building, that it cannot affect us externally. And they bombed all of their weapons caches. And that leads me to what comes next. But I just want to, you know, take a breather here. Sorry to filibuster. That's where I think we are until now.
You know, and all of that makes sense. And I think, with all of the, you know, World War III kind of fear mongers, it's a little disappointing maybe to them that, Russia and some of these other countries are kind of backing off this particular conflict. And so with that, with the United States and our current posture with President Trump, Is that wise to assist Israel, or in the context of all of these other nations that are kind of declining to support Iran, would it make more sense potentially to say, you know what, we're going to leave this kind of with Israel and Iran and maybe low-key provide some resources to Israel, but not as open as Trump has been. And maybe that's not even possible for somebody like Donald Trump to do anything quietly. But what's your take on this kind of intervention, but not full-blown,
sure,
you know, robust kind of escalation?
Sure. So couple things here. We have to ask the right questions. We have to be prudent. But at the same time, we can't be governed completely by the past, where we tell the world that for the rest of our lives, we are so traumatized by what we did in Iraq, which frankly was not war or combat. It was social work in a combat zone, and it was the worst of all. We haven't fought a war since the Gulf War, by the way. Really, I mean, that's what we've been doing. The military is superb, the best in the world, at breaking things and killing people. Now, you have to see when it's appropriate and in our interest and what and how much to do. What it can't do is go on the ground and referee Islamic civil wars and build stuff for them while both sides are killing us. Okay, and I think I have a lot of confidence in Trump that he clearly understands that. In fact, he opposed the Iraq stuff before anyone in the Republican Party did. So I think he definitely gets that. And I'm not worried about him repeating that mistake. I think too many of the critics are looking in the past, and also, like you insinuated, they're almost upset that Israel didn't get destroyed. It's like, it is totally valid if you're coming to me a few weeks ago, hey, do you think we should try to, you know, attack Iran's nuclear program right now? I don't know. I mean, I'm working on a bunch of domestic issues I'd rather focus on. I mean, now do we really need to do that? What's going to happen? You know, what's the risk versus return matrix? But it happened. It was spectacularly successful. Here's where it is. So we need to be debating this in good faith. Okay. So the 800-pound gorilla in the room is, what should American involvement be or not be? Mm-hmm. There's a few ways to answer that. On the one hand, I would say I don't want us to do anything more than we're already doing. Almost a lot of it is just because of, not even strategically, just because of the political situation at home. Just so you don't have people for the rest of time yelping a war for Jews, which is what they want to say. So that's partly why. But one of the things that some of them are saying, which I agree with a lot, is they're saying they don't want regime change. Now, I have to say there's a difference between not actively helping prop up the mullahs, because at this point you might need an act to actually prop them up. They might fall on their own, versus saying we are going to feel responsible to deal with what happens afterwards. It's the latter that we emphatically certainly have to say no to. Certainly Trump, when he makes his decision and gives a speech, needs to give people the confidence that he has no plans of doing that. Obviously, we don't support the Lindsey Graham mentality, you know, which a lot of the Tuckers are using as their sort of punching bag and red herring to oppose doing what's prudent and rational and realist at this point, and reaping the benefits of what clearly we're getting without, you know, suffering the risk and liability. So he needs to make it clear we're not doing that. The question is, strategically on the ground, what does Israel need and not need? And I don't know the answer to that. Neither do these people have the answer to that. I think we should all have the goal. If the goal is that we don't necessarily want them to fall and certainly deal with that internally, we just want to make sure that whatever controls that territory, whether it's the current regime very much weakened or something else, they do not have nuclear facilities. And even if someone felt that even that goal was too ambitious to begin with, well, Israel already did it. So if it's just a question of destroying Fordow and one or two other things and sending in bunker buster missiles, here's the question for these people. If you don't want the Iranian regime to fall, right, and you want to just defang but then not have the chaos, in that case, it would be the most prudent thing to have America come in and just do that. And it's in and out, bomb. And remember, Israel did the hard work, the ops on the ground, the risk, the air defenses that they had to go through. That's done. So come in, have fun, use the toys that we spend so much money for and never use, and done. Now, if you're going to say warmonger, well, okay, so then the problem is if you leave it to Israel, that lacks the capability to do it in a one-and-done way without destroying more of their infrastructure, then the Iranian regime might fall. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but I'm saying these people who emphatically say they don't want it to fall, they need to consider that, you know, it might be the best thing to just say, look, Trump say it's a limited scope, we're destroying the nuclear reactor, we're out.
Yeah, and hopefully there is that much tact and strategy and perhaps restraint behind the Trump administration's goals. And yet we know that some of the Republicans are warmongers, frankly. I mean, you know, and they would like to see more American intervention. And so what should we expect in the next couple of weeks in terms of where this is headed? I mean, obviously the conflict with Israel and Gaza and Hezbollah has and Hamas has gone on after the October 7th of 2023. I mean, that's gone on a lot longer than I think anyone anticipated. And so are we thinking that this conflict may also be protracted?
I mean, look, there is no evidence that there's anything outside. And look, I'm going to tell you something interesting. I actually criticized the Trump administration for taking off sanctions on al-Jalani, the new guy in Syria. I mean, he was an al-Qaeda guy, so much American blood on his hands. And what bothered me is that was part of a number of overtures to Qatar and Saudi Arabia that just concerned me. It just concerns me, you know, and it's kind of interesting that people who complain about Israel influence or whatever, somehow they're not concerned about jihadist Muslim Brotherhood influence, which is very interesting. They weren't bothered by any of that Wilsonian intervention, you know, all the investments we're having Qatar invest in data centers in rural America, which is very, very concerning, you know, at a time that we're trying to get rid of Chinese ownership or investment in critical infrastructure. I've been very critical of the Trump administration on that. And I'm still bothered by the timing of that move in the context of the broader Qatar alignment, which I don't like. But with that said, I got to give him credit that, you know what? At least he got something for it. Jalani was like, hey, I'm not attacking Israel. And quite the contrary, they're free to come here and deal with Iran. So, you know, I think they have thought this out very well diplomatically, and I think the Trump administration has done a good job on that front. And the dirty little secret is none of these people wanted Iranian hegemony. They just didn't. You know, obviously, before Israel would do it, they'd, oh, no, you can't do it. But everyone knows that privately, the Jordanians, Egyptians, and even Saudis are communicating with the Israeli, you know, foreign ministry. And so the notion that anyone's upset about the mullahs not having a bomb is absurd. And I think that's the dirty little thing. I don't want to put words in other people's mouths. And people have legitimate concerns and PTSD from what we've done in the past. But I will say, as it relates to someone like Tucker, it is abundantly clear that he has no problem with the mullahs having a nuclear bomb. And in fact, he might want that. That's pretty clear. He is rooting for the Iranians. Other people, it's just like they're just concerned. We just want to make sure we don't repeat the mistakes. And look, Jenna, I have those same concerns. I was not beating the drums of war. But you got to, being a conservative is dealing with the world as it exists. And Israel has remade the map, certainly in the last 5 days, but also there was a whole buildup the last year that they, I mean, between what they did and certain things naturally, just with the conclusion of the Syrian civil war, that you have all these Sunni countries, and again, I don't think very highly of them, but that's not the point, that strategically they have no interest in screwing with Israel anymore, and they're very happy to have Iran defanged.
Mm. And, you know, with all of that, then, is there, I mean, what would constitute victory or resolution from an Israeli perspective? I mean, when we talk about, you know, what goals we should have as the United States with respect to funding to Ukraine or support in, you know, Israel's conflict with Gaza. And I don't think that the U.S. has defined any of those things particularly well. Has Israel defined what would constitute victory?
They have. And I think we certainly shouldn't over-define it more than they have. What has been very clear from most Israeli officials that I've seen is that they're agnostic about regime change. Now, again, I want to say within that there's two parts. Notice Israel has never been on the ground doing nation building. Notice they never do that. They strike and maneuver. And that's what we need to stop. Not that we want any war, you know, for the sake of it, but we need to eschew this false dichotomy between war means what we've been doing. And in fact, I would say people forget, you know, they might say, well, Daniel, we don't know how to do that anymore. You're going back to World War II. It's actually not true. Trump brags about this all the time. They say Trump never got us involved in a war, and now he's going to tarnish his legacy getting us involved in war. But in fact, you know this, he brags all the time that he crushed ISIS. Okay, we actually did that. There were a few hundred fighters in Mosul. We leveled the place. Okay, that's what we did. We went in and leveled it. Now, we actually had more on the ground. We did have special ops somewhere with the Kurds, but elsewhere as well. Marines. I actually opposed it because I felt that was helping Iran, and it did. But God orchestrated events thereafter that erased those gains. That Iran was at the pinnacle of their power because we became the Shiite Air Force. So I didn't agree with it strategically, but tactically we did it right. The military is good at crushing things. What we can't do is deal with the civil stuff. So what Israel has never done that. So what it looks like is, for 46 years, the Middle East has been under the shield of the Iranian Empire. People forget they took our ship and humiliated us under Obama. They're blocking our shipping lanes in the Red Sea. They have the most American blood on their hands of anyone. A lot of people are like, I don't want our troops going to the Middle East. Now, we could debate about what we should keep and not keep there, and I think we need to bring some home. But we already have about 40,000 troops permanently there, flung out through about 10 nations. They're constantly under threat because of that umbrella. Israel has removed that, okay, for free. So what victory looks like is that in the land that we currently call Iran, they are fanged from the capability of engaging, number one, nuclear, number two, ICBMs, and number three, exporting external terrorism, and that they're degraded to a point that now Israel has enough intel and control over it, not on the ground, that if they see trouble from now and then, you come and mow the lawn. You're never going to get permanent victory in the Middle East. We shouldn't seek utopia. You're not going to get it. There's not going to be that as long as Islam is around doing its thing. But the point is that look at Syria now. I don't trust that Al-Jalani guy from here to Mars. But the point is, they cleared out the weaponry. And I want to say one other thing, Jenna. A lot of people talk about, yeah, just like Iran not having WMD, you know, they're lying here. Well, what, so the nuclear facilities are made up? But number two, and more importantly, people forget, do you know why there was no WMD in Iraq? Because Israel freaking bombed it in 1981. And then they did it in Syria 5 years ago. Strike and maneuver. By the way, there was no World War III either time. Strike and maneuver. Done. That we need to learn from what they're doing when we feel it's in our interest. There used to be a feeling, and Colin Powell believed in this strongly. You break it, you own it. And that's what's governed us since then. That we feel the need, oh my gosh, now what do we do? No. We have the right to mind our own business. You exported terrorism forever. You can't have these guys have nuclear weapons. We're going to take away your toys. Does that mean they fall? Not. I don't care. Is it perfect? No, but nothing is, and it's better than any other alternative.
And that is more of a discrete, focused plan and declaration of what victory actually would constitute from Israel. Do you think that at this point, at least as we're recording this podcast today, the Trump administration shares that if they recognize that as the definition of victory?
People need to understand, you know, I am not shy about criticizing the president, and I've been doing that for 10 years. But when it comes to this, he has really threaded the needle properly. Believe me, if anything, there is more inertia on him in the other direction of not wanting to touch this. He had no interest for a number of reasons. You know, he's struggling because of the courts and Congress, and I would argue some of their own ineptitude in implementing some of his campaign promises and sticking the landing on immigration. The last thing he needed or wanted was this. Clearly, what he saw presented to him was a clear opportunity, low risk, high return, and clearly they were headed towards, you know, getting that nuclear bomb very, very soon. You know, I'm not someone who blindly puts my trust in Trump, but clearly where he was coming from, because you saw the lead up to it, and I know people talk about a deception, but it is also true that he did restrain Israel a lot, and it surprised a lot of people. You had Witkoff, who is a Qatari agent that's been doing a lot of this stuff. There's a lot of people in the admin that, you know, were against this, and Trump himself was going back and forth. Trump has no interest in doing that. And to be fair, Trump learned that before we did. To be fair, he was never in favor. It's not like, oh, did he learn the lesson of Iraq? He opposed doing that to begin with. So one thing I'm very confident is that he has no interest in trying to govern them and deal with, you know, what comes next.
And I agree with that analysis. And listeners know, you know, I've like you, and I think this is in part why we're friends, you know, have been very willing to criticize or critique Trump's policy or things that he said or whatever when it's necessary from a genuinely objective conservative perspective, and then to laud him when he makes the right decision, which is frequent. I mean, this is something where I'm very glad that we have a President Trump instead of a Kamala Harris dealing with, you know, a lot of these things. And so, you know, overall then, and just to wrap, I mean, we could spend hours on this conversation,
sure.
Daniel, and I really appreciate it so much. You know, where does the U.S. go from here in terms of the overall Republican base? Because we're seeing this, and you mentioned, you know, Tucker and kind of this fracturing because Trump called him out, and, you know, and now some are suggesting that they're pro-Tucker versus pro-Trump. And I think all of that is a little ridiculous. We can stick to the issues, not the personalities. But overall, with kind of the America First segment of the base that is America only, and they don't see any strategy or rationale to basically ever aid our allies, which is, I think, a very limited and frankly very naive perspective. And then there's, you know, there's the spectrum, of course. There's some people who, well, this much intervention this far and no more, and
by the way, they had no problem giving hundreds of billions in weapons contracts and sales to the Sunni Arab states there. That was part of this deal. It's kind of interesting, by the way.
Yeah, and you know, and great point. And so, you know, it seems like
they're
there's
not
a
isolationists,
lot of,
by the way. They're not isolationists. You could debate isolationism. I'm pretty, you know, pretty restrained with that. But they're, let's just call a spade a spade. These people hate Israel. And again, I don't mean all the people that feel like they need to follow the bullies because they're a bunch of little girls and their whole life is a digital locker room. But I mean the leaders in this. And here's how I know that. I'll end with a political point. It's a little bit interesting being me this week. I have spent 10 years tiptoeing around, walking on eggshells, being the one to say, Trump is endorsing every stinking rhino. Why are we not fighting back as a base? Trump is screwing us. I mean, just last week with the farm amnesty, he walked it back a little bit, but still, that's a looming threat. But endless more Chinese visas. He says he cut a deal. So think about it. These guys are like, dude, this sucks. It's a war for Israel. It's just, you know, we need to focus on China. Okay, so then Trump's like, let's let in their modality of asymmetrical warfare is to bring in their trade theft and counterintelligence and espionage and cultural subversion. And it's like the responses ranged from silence to muted complaints for years. Again, I'm not trying to bash Trump here. I'm trying to make a point. COVID, you know, a day after Trump announced that the COVID vaccine saved millions of lives, years after it was known that they killed so many people, Tucker interviewed him and had him right across the desk and refused to bring it up. Okay? By the way, I'm old enough to remember when Tucker flew down to Mar-a-Lago March 2020 and implored him to lock down. But, you know, again, that's neither here nor there. So the point is, like, you know, I am the ultimate America First. What's my focus? Red state legislatures, America's heartland, preserving our land. You know, Trump is bringing in Qatari money to build these AI data centers that are sucking out the energy and water. I mean, I could go on and on. If you are truly like, yeah, America first and screw everyone else and America's heartland and patriotism, keep out the immigrants, you know, globalists, use all their tropes. I have 50 million things they could work on and be upset at Trump and that are ongoing. And yet it's like I'm the pariah for bringing this up. I mean, you know this. It's very difficult. Even sometimes, even I kind of talk around it a little bit because they'll come with a lynch mob. And yet when it comes to this, not restraining Israel from what was successfully making sure that the biggest lunatics ever didn't get a hold of a nuclear bomb, these guys, like, can't handle themselves. Like, we're dying! Like, actually, the Israelis are back to work today. I mean, you might want to try that. But then again, their job is grifting off of low IQ sophistry online, and they have found a way of getting subscribers and making a lot of money that way. They don't care about anything. They're like a snake that doesn't even benefit from its bite. There's just no purpose to what these people do. You know, they're all yelping about Lindsey Graham. Do you know I have spent three cycles trying to defeat him, and we're already on the second round of Trump endorsing him, second cycle, 6 years ago, and now. They didn't yelp when, you know, you have legitimate candidates actually would run, and some might still. It's funny, like, okay, so you hate Lindsey Graham. Are you going to help me defeat it and create a lynch mob to yell at Trump to get him to rescind his endorsement? And there's many other examples of that across the country. No, there's nothing constructive about these people. They suck, okay? They don't believe in their own talking points. I want you to understand that these people do not believe in a darn word they say.
Yeah, and all of that is so well said, Daniel Horowitz, and I appreciate you spending so much time with us here on Demand this morning. And so we'll wrap here, but you know, thank you for your overall perspective and always driving this back to what America First truly should be and the conservative perspective, because we really, really need to just drive this point home that it's not about Donald Trump. It's not about non-Donald Trump or, you know, never Trump or any of those things. Ultimately, what America First should be is to persist in the principles and the foundations of liberty that our nation was founded on and continues. And I think that when we lose sight of that and when we have these kind of personalities like Tucker that frankly aren't all that helpful sometimes, that are kind of a given to whoever is funding them, in my opinion, then we end up with policy that is confused and inconsistent. And so it then is incumbent upon us, some of the voices, and you are one of the most prolific voices out there right now in the blaze on your podcast, that and on your X feed. I encourage everyone to follow you at RM Conservative to point this out and to continue to say, you know, here's how we should thread the needle. Here's where Trump is doing well. Here's where, you know, he could do better. And those are the charges really for conservatives to preserve into the next generation the true calling of liberty. So thank you so much for coming on this morning for On Demand. And as always, for listeners, you can suggest a topic, a guest, what you want to hear about and who you want to hear from to my email, jenna@afr.net. And we will have another conversation next Friday.